And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and I welcome Nathan Englander to the program today. Nathan won the Frank O'Connor International Short Story Award and was a finalist for the Pulitzer for his collection, What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank. In addition to fiction, Nathan writes for the stage and has also won a Guggenheim Fellowship. Today we'll be talking about his fifth book of fiction, Caddish.com, which is published by Knopf. Nathan, before we get into the story, could you tell us, Goyim, what saying the Kaddish is all about in the Jewish tradition?
That is definitely relevant to a book called Kaddish.com. So, yes, I wanted to tell a certain kind of story, which I'm sure we'll unpack here, but I believe a story should have a pressurized form to it, and I could think of nothing better than the Kaddish, as if you're looking at family and family pressures, because there is this prayer, Kael Malei Rachamim, which can also be called prayer for the dead, but this is basically the mourner's prayer, the prayer for the dead. And when a Jewish person dies, the belief is that they're, you know, being judged for a year, but we don't know anyone so bad that needs a full year of judgment. So you say Kaddish for 11 months, and you need to say it with a quorum, with a minyan. So you have to go to a synagogue 3 times a day, and you say the prayer, it ends up being 8 times a day in total. So it is this enormous obligation, you know, where you are literally the dead person's, like, for their spirit, you are their advocate on this earth, you know, for their space in the world to come.
How do you round enough people up 3 times a day to be there?
I'm wearing a baseball hat, but I don't cover my head all the time. I ain't religious anymore, but I grew up really religious. And if you grow up in that world, like, everyone goes to synagogue, like, you get a minyan together. And even that, I can remember, you know, as our town was building now, I was just out there recently, the town I grew up in suburbia, and there's the main synagogue and the breakaway synagogue and this synagogue, and the town has really grown Jewishly. But I can really remember, like, you know, my father getting a call on, like, Sunday afternoon where, you know, like, they're a man short. Back to that, which this book also explores, idea of, you know, egalitarian and women's roles and things like that play into the story. But yes, as I grew up, it was only men. It needed 10 men for that. But yeah, you'd get a call and being like, we're one short, get down here, time to pray.
One of the things I've always admired about Judaism is the people are very practical when dealing with the laws in the book. And they're going, let's set up an Eruv so we can go somewhere on the Sabbath and things like that.
Oh, you are a ringer. Like, that is an awesome example. You know, you're so nice to bring that up, and I always appreciate a close read. But I really believe in story being universal. You know, you end up being a writer because you're a reader. And if you can't enter into a world, the writer has failed you. So yes, if you know your stuff in this book, there's all kinds of stuff in there, but I really built it, this idea, it should have the instructions inside is kind of how I say it. But when you get to the legal stuff, you're hitting on what is a really sweet point to me. As I said, I can play both sides. I grew up religious and I'm not religious, and that's part of this book. I really went back to that place in my head where I can really advocate for the faithful side of things and really advocate for the, like, secular humanist side of things. But what you're saying, religion has a lot of rules to it, and Judaism gets really strict if you're really religious, but I find it so beautiful that you start with the maximum, and then you sort of dial it down from there. Like, in the end, the goal is to make things work, and I think that's kind of sweet, which gets to the .com part of Kaddish.com. So yes, you know, the father is dead, a religious man. His son is the only one, you know, Larry, who we meet at the start of the book, he's the only one who can say this prayer. His sister Dina is also really religious and freaking out. He's the only one who can say it. And he's just not a religious guy. And that's just too much to ask of someone who's not religious. No one's going for 11 months if they're not religious 3 times. I mean, it's just too enormous of a thing to ask. And I think it's really sweet because there is in Judaism this idea of a proxy. You know, like, you mentioned Erev, which is like a physical proxy for a town. That's like the physical form of it. But I kind of love it. Like, I was just in December, I went to Moscow for book tour, which was fascinating for me. It was my first trip there. I'd never been on tour there before. But my mother, before the flight, she's still, you know, a traditional person. She gives me $18, which is, you know, chai, the Jewish number. She gives me $18 to give to charity. Like, you know, here's your money. When you get there, you find someone, you give it to charity, give it to someone in need, put it in a charity box. And that idea behind that is that I am then protected on my flight and on my big journey, because it's no longer me, Nathan, on a flight. You know, the person now occupying that seat is a proxy for my mother, who was on a mission to do a good deed. That is like one of my favorite forms of Jewish proxy. But Larry, who's just not going to do it, we can get to that part, but he's looking at pornography and feels quite guilty about it. We can talk about sex guilt and Jewish guilt and Catholic guilt and all those kinds of guilts. He's, yes, in that space. And then he stumbles on this site, Kaddish.com, where he can hire a proxy, which again, I've put it inside the internet, but this is also, as you can imagine, this is not the first family in my book that it's come up for. It happens in real life all the time, surely for all time, where there isn't a person to say the prayer. He hires a student through the internet. You can hire someone to say the prayer for the dead who can keep your family member in mind. And the nicest part about touring, I'm so thankful, like thank you anyone for listening to this and for reading books and supporting books. If you're were in the studio with us, there's just, I'm paying attention. It is about me, but this interview, but there's books behind me. I just want to go through the stacks as a book person. But once you're out on the road, I get to hear from people. And, you know, I once made up a story about like a Hasidic man in my first book, For the Relief of Unbearable Urges, this story, Reb Kringle, about a Hasidic man, long white beard, big belly, can't afford to pay for his little tiny synagogue. So he works as a Santa Claus in Macy's. So I made up this idea of a Jewish Santa Claus. In the 20 years since that story came out, I can't even tell you, I've met like every Jewish Santa Claus in America, and they are legion. There's many more than I thought. But this book has been out for 2 weeks, and already some nice readers who read it right off have come out. Like, I've had such stories, like love. I'm hearing people's stories. I've met so many people who in their family that they hired someone to say this prayer because they just, you know, they can mourn in their own way, but they wanted it done strictly and they weren't the person for the job. And I think that's beautiful.
Does the person they hired take it on for the entire 11 months or is there like a schedule?
Just talking about this in San Diego and so many different cities around the country, it's come up and I've heard different versions, but yes, you would hire them for the 11 months, you know, when they're saying the prayer, keep your relative in mind, you know, like think of them and that's how it works. And I also, when you mentioned, you know, the rules part of religion and that kind of, you know, the Eruv, which is lovely, that's, you're not allowed to carry on the Sabbath outside a certain area, like if it's not enclosed. So literally like the town I grew up in, from the telephone poles, they hook a wire around the town and that makes the whole town counts as an enclosed space. And there's so many laws like that, but I go down the rabbit hole for a book. A book better be an unbroken dream. You better enter into it and enter another reality that's a real reality to you. But coming out of it, like the underpinnings of that world, I need to know everything to write the story. So you better not see that. You better not have that research weighing you down. But I really care about the like logic, the continuity. I live in Brooklyn, so nobody has real jobs in Brooklyn. It's like weird. All the parents are around during the day, except if people are like are on set or so. There's a lot of movie people, a lot of writers, you know, a lot of people in the arts in my neighborhood. It's really like an artsy village. But I always say to them, like, I'd want a job as the continuity guy on set. Like, I'd love to say, like, her button was closed in that scene. Like, you know, his hair was, it's shifted. I love watching for, I need to know everything, where it goes, how it was, and then I can watch for change. So back to paying for this service. I read all the books as an ex, you know, religious kid. I have my books. I have my father's, I have this lovely, the family books. I have all that library on my shelves that I go to. The internet is great. You know, like I do all my research, you know, libraries, all that stuff. But then I end up, I had a lovely talk with this rabbi who's really wise, you know, who my family knows. Like I reached out to him. I was like, he's a real thinker. I didn't thank him in the book. That was almost a rabbinical question, which is the book has some dirty parts. So I was like, is it nicer to thank someone by name who probably wouldn't want to be thanked in this slightly irreverent novel? You know, so yes, I will get him something nice. But we agreed. He was told you are not being thanked. He agreed with that. But he made such a good point when we were talking about the idea of proxies, because I needed to know, Larry, there's a jump after the first section, like a 20-year elision space where he becomes born again. Once he becomes Shuli, once he becomes religious again, he recognizes, he has this moment working with one of his students, he teaches at his old school, that like knocks him off his seat, basically. And he recognizes when he hired this person, he basically made a deal to give his father's soul away. And now he wants it back. That's one of the big engines of the book. But as for paying, I thought, is it better that it be done as a favor? Like, is it something more upsetting about hiring a proxy and paying them, like whether you make a donation to an institution or actually pay that student? And it actually, it's probably even religiously better that they be paid, because then it's so concrete. Like the transaction is very clear. The obligation being, it's a form of kinyan. Like there's many ways to make a deal, and that transfer really is a transfer. So actually, if someone would say I'm doing it as a favor, it is equally good or maybe even a little bit better to have paid someone.
But it sounds like there should be a call-in radio show called Shonda or Mitzvah.
Yeah, exactly. Literally, that's funny. Yes. Yeah, Shonda, Busha, Vacherpa, these are all insults for shame. Shonda is a shame. When you were in trouble in high school, the trio was that was the biggest one. If you got Shonda, Busha, and Cherpa, that was like, you're a big mess, get out of class. You would. Yes.
How many of those did you get?
You know what? That's really at the core of this book, which is I wish I was naughtier. I was so rebellious, but in the nerdiest, most theological way. Like my rebellion, it wasn't sneaking out of class. It wasn't stealing. It wasn't, you know, ripping bong hits. I wasn't smoking cigarettes. I was like very, you know, my dad smoked.
What were you doing then?
Asking questions, biblically, theologically challenging questions, which is part of what this book is. I think about my teachers. I was thinking about grade school teachers on the road. I keep saying like, oh, these teachers, they must be long dead. I think of them as long dead. I was like, they were so old. But now that I'm getting older, you know, if you look at a picture of your first grade teacher that seemed ancient, like maybe she was like 32. So maybe those rabbis are 50, but I imagine a lot of them are no longer with us. They seemed very, very old. Oh yeah. So I can remember like being thrown out of class literally for me saying like the question of omniscience, like you're asking me to believe that there's a being that can know what everybody in the world has done, like everything they've done. And it knows this single brain knows where everybody is right now. And it also gives you free will, but it knows what you're going to do next. Like I'd get thrown out for those kind of questions. Like what a giant ask. You're making this as like, as if it's a proof, as if it's like, you know, all the philosophical a priori stuff, like as if this is an assumed basic thing to logic, you know, just like, oh yes, the world is round and there's a being that knows, you know, get out. Shonda, there you go. Go get lost. Just don't get caught. And then I thought about where we are now in the world. Like if you are, you know, in the global north, or, you know, now it's, you know, pretty much everywhere is plugged in. But if you have a smartphone, if you're walking by CCTV cameras, like going into a bank using a bank machine, if you've Googled anything, signed into Facebook, like at this point, the internet really does know everything you've done. It knows right where you are right now. Like everybody knows right where I am now because I was on an airplane to get here. It's like that idea. You press your, you know, ride service, you like the flight. I am so easily trackable. And this weird thing that I've noticed lately, which is the ads that I get in my feeds are so shocking. Like they're not partly on point. You know what I'm saying? Like I would dare anyone to think about who's listening to this, think about getting a puppy. And before you even like Google adopt a puppy, you will be getting dog food ads. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah, because I'll literally get stuff that I say out loud but haven't actually done the search for, yes, and will pop up.
Yes. So that's what I'm saying. Like back to this kind of listening and knowing, like that's the point. My wife asked me for something. I was running out to the store. Oh yeah, could you get this? I didn't even think about it. Like it was for my daughter. My wife made the request. I opened my phone and it's in there. Like not food equals food or carb equals carb, but like the literal specific thing. And I thought that is so creepy. So I'm like, we have, you know, like that's what I was saying about them being possibly long dead, but that I'd like to apologize to some of them because I was like, oh, this idea of omniscience, like, and it's not a Christian God because the internet is mean. So it is a vengeful Old Testament Jewish God that's also trying to sell you stuff. But we have done a really good job. I mean, the internet's pretty new. You know, we were just talking before we started taping, like the idea that you can record this, that you can make video, like the processing power, like we've built a pretty good simulacrum, like a beta God in the last decade of the internet getting fast.
Talking about questioning, I worked up a list of questions for God. Yeah. I was just kind of bored one day. I said, yeah, I'd like to know this, this, and this. And my number one question, the one if I only got to ask one, is exactly what are you getting out of this?
That's awesome. That's excellent. You can have a one-sided radio show where you just ask questions of God and then we all listen.
It gets tedious pretty quick.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't even think it'd make a full McSweeney's thing.
Yeah, yeah, that's funny. The full McSweeney's, that's it. That's funny.
speaking of experiencing different worlds and getting you into that world, why did you pick Memphis as the place his sister and father would move to?
Oh, it's really clear. And my point is, you know, Memphis was in my thoughts because it's in the book. But oh, I was just saying my favorite questions on tour. I like certain kind of questions. But I was in San Diego and someone was doing an interview there, like before I got there. And they said, what city are you most excited to visit on tour? And I was like, San Diego, obviously. But I was, in fact, talking to the San Diego Jewish paper. Anyway, so yes, as for Memphis, it really, there's always the things that are for people you know and people you love. Like I have some, you know, dear Memphis friends. So that gets into your psyche. Like you're thinking of a place and I'm like, oh, I love these people. The place has a sweet spot in my mind. But more so like the concrete writerly, like metaphysical reason is because part of this book is about home. Like when we meet Larry, you know, he lives in Brooklyn in the not religious neighborhood. Like I live in Clinton Hill and I put Larry in Clinton Hill, which is maybe the only neighborhood in Brooklyn. Like on Passover, like our supermarket doesn't even carry matzah. And then last year they got matzah and it says not kosher for Passover on the box. And I thought, who starts a business that they're going to make matzah, but they're going to make matzah that's not kosher? That fascinated me because that is a very niche industry that we have many of them in Brooklyn.
That's a whole lot of conflicted feelings a person has when they eat that.
Yes, exactly. Right. Yes. It's communion wafers that are not good for communion, just for snacking.
You just love the taste.
Yes, exactly. Oh, yeah. So he's a Brooklyn guy. He grew up in Brooklyn. That's his home. He lives 4 subway stops from where he grew up. And then he's down in Memphis, you know, in this religious community. And his sister saying, come home, basically. And his father on his deathbed in Memphis when he's in the hospital here, that's where he dies. He's like, one day you'll come home. And I was thinking about what that means, you know, the Jewish idea of home and what it means outside of time and space. You know, it really interested me because as someone, you know, who grew up so religious in that Orthodox world, like if you're a certain kind of Jew, let's say like a young Israel Orthodox, I was going to say a chain, it's not Chipotle, but it's a, you know, it's a linked synagogues, you know, they're all related, the young Israel, you know, it'll be like young Israel of West Hempstead, that was mine, and then it'll be young Israel of Oceanside, you know. Oh, point is, there really is this connection that has nothing to do with space, you know, that you build these communities, and it'll be the same, like that's part of the warmth of it and the closed nature of it and the connected nature across time and space. Like what keeps Jews going with so much motion of like the Jews of Baghdad end up being the Jews of Poland, end up being the Jews of, you know, Long Island, like this motion. Even me who's not religious, I talked about the Moscow trip. I was probably like through customs for maybe like 3 or 4 hours. And suddenly I was in eating the best kosher food I ever had. I was at this kosher Georgian restaurant with my publisher, like drinking whiskey with Hasidim around. Like if you ask me what percentage of the world is Jewish, I say like, I don't know, 98%. Is that too much? Like, you know, thinking about that, like my sister moved down to Florida 20 years ago, like her community, I have to get used to it. I was like, oh, it's Jews with palm trees. Like it's, but the food is the same. The prayers are the same. The way people live are the same. So that notion, whether you drop that sort of specific Orthodox community, put it in Memphis, put it in LA, drop it anywhere in the world. Yes, the weather may change some, the food may change some, you know, accents change some, but it is, that is the notion of home. Like that's what she means, the sister, when she's like, come home, you know, because that's what he's defending. He's like, come home. You live in Memphis now. Like home to us has subways, but it's not about going underground to travel. Home to her is a kosher home or a religious home. It's a certain idea or identity. And yes, that's why I chose Memphis, because it really, really fits for this book. You can move anywhere, but you move anywhere and you move into the same kind of community, and they really are connected. You know, I say in the book, when he's born again, Shuli ends up in Israel. That's as far as I'll go in terms of spoiler, now that my books have plots in a certain way. But it really is true that you're more likely to bump into someone, a certain kind of person like Shuli from my made-up Brooklyn neighborhood of Royal Hills, but that he'd be more likely to maybe bump into someone from Royal Hills, Brooklyn, you know, in central Jerusalem, then say on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. I could tell you 2 stories from this tour that I don't think I've told them yet. I was on stage doing an event. One of my nephews I knew he was getting engaged. I knew it was about to happen. And I get off stage and, you know, I'm signing books and very nice. I was taking a picture with someone. I was very thankful for the support. and, you know, being friendly. But when it was done and it was just like this woman who I'd not met, ever met before, the moderator, when there's a couple of us left, when there would have been a few minutes more chatter, I really, if you're Orthodox also, the engagement becomes a party, like you go meet the family, you know, there's dancing and that kind of stuff. Point is, I say to her, this has been so nice, I'd love to talk longer, but I've got to run. I think my nephew got engaged. I've never met this woman. She said, he's already engaged. You know what I'm saying? Like, she'd already got a text or an Instagram. Like, she already knew that. Like, this person I've never spoken to before. Even last night, I was in Houston last night, and this nice woman who I'd met once before is so lovely. She says to me, like, oh, where are you going tomorrow? I say, Memphis. She's like, I'll send my sister. We get to talking. I happen to mention a different Memphis name of my sister's friend, and I hear her sister's name, and I was like, oh, she's coming already to the event, because I'd already gotten a text from my sister, from her friend, and it's her friend's sister-in-law is this woman's sister. So I literally had in my phone, I literally remember the name because I'd just seen it. My sister said, oh, this person's coming. So yeah, I'm going to tell my sister, maybe she'll come. Like, I've never met her sister. And I was like, oh, she's already coming. And I know. And that kind of link from, you know, whether I'm doing the local New York one or this Houston, like, I love that, that the Houston person and the like, it's just, it is one single world, one single home, but it's spread out.
I want to tell you a story of weird coincidence that will not make it into the show. We have a volunteer, and she was reading. Eric Larson wrote a book about the American ambassador during Nazi Germany.
Yes.
And the volunteer was reading it, and she was mangling the German names.
Yeah.
And I said, I can help you out with the pronunciation of these. And she goes, well, I should know better because my aunt has lived in Germany for 20 years, and I go over to visit. I should know how to pronounce these. I said, oh, where does she live? She goes, small town, you never heard of it. I said, try me. And she said, Neuhof.
Yeah.
And my ex-wife is German. I lived in Hamburg with her.
Oh, no way.
And her mother lives in Neuhof.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I was still friendly with her, even though we'd gotten divorced. And I said, hey, do you know this woman and this address? And within 3 seconds, she texted me a photograph of her aunt's house. And she had walked up. It's a town of 650, maybe.
Yeah,
and it just...
Right, isn't that like, I love those things, especially as someone who writes fiction and I like Dickens. It's been a long, I should go reread some Dickens, but there's a lot of books to read. But like those kind of Dickensian things, they happen all the time. In real life, it's much harder to execute them in fiction. But the number of times you have like those bizarre, like that's just, you know, that impossible connection. Like, oh, that, I find that so beautiful. I love those stories. Do you speak German?
Ein bisschen, ja.
Oh, that's already better than me. We got to live in Berlin for a few months and we loved it. So much. I really like fell in love with that country. And we try, you know, whenever I'm traveling, I try to get there.
Yeah. Knowing German does help with somewhat with the Yiddish.
Yeah. I was just talking about the dialects because I was traveling. Where was this? In Berkeley. But a guy who's like fluent in Yiddish, but a more Polish, you know, we were talking about like where you can understand things. Cause like, yeah, good Germanic Yiddish, you can really, you have a pretty good jump, an excellent jump on German, I feel like.
When I pictured Larry in my mind, there's a stand-up comedian named Ari Shaffir. Are you familiar with him? And he was raised very Orthodox and then rebelled. And he's gone completely secular.
Oh,
and,
cool.
But he's super hairy, just looks sweaty all the time. And he's just so aggrieved and just screams all the time. And I was trying to figure out of all the different words for kind of jerk that are in Yiddish, which one would.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And the one that I found was a Gruben Junge, because just a...
It was me, like an angry...
Screaming young guy.
Yeah, and that's funny.
Because I didn't know what kind of particular jerk he was.
Yeah.
There's just so many great words in Yiddish for that.
Ari Shaffir, I'm going to look that up.
He's an acquired taste.
He's up for comedy. I will.
He's gone full secular.
Yeah, awesome. That's funny. I only know there's a guy in Jerusalem who's doing pretty well as a comedian who's gone the other way. He's like the black hat. Anyway. Yes.
Were you a Modest Yahoo fan at all back in the last decade?
I remember when he was huge. One thing that was driving this book, speaking of that, because I think he's not religious again, maybe.
Yeah, he left Orthodox.
Yeah, because that's one of the other notion that drives this book. So one thing I'm really interested in is executing the inexecutable. Like everything I write, I think when I think of it, I think, oh, there's no way to build this. There's no way to get to this point that I'm thinking about, or there's no way to execute this. That's what keeps me interested in my room is like, oh, now I have to come up with a universe where if you line up all the parts where this like sort of reverse engineering a universe like that, that obsesses me. And one thing I've noticed, I mean, it's 20 years since the first book, Like, I think that's what got me to this book. I was writing Dinner at the Center of the Earth, my last book, which is about Israel and Palestine, and I didn't want to be didactic. So I was like, oh, what if it's a literary book as usual, but what if it's like a literary political thriller that's also magic realist, you know, that's also a love story, that's also an allegory, you know, with all my timelines. Like, I felt like, you know, how did I get here as a writer? And it made me think about where I began, and it took me back to the start. But one thing I've noticed back to where I started, like I told that Santa Claus story, and we were talking before it went on, we both used to have really long hair. But when I had really long hair, I would go to my sister's house for Shabbat dinner, and her friends would say, like, her religious friends, like, oh, I could make such a wig out of that hair. And I thought, that's funny, eh? I thought that was a really funny thing to say. But then I thought, the joke part, like, jokes have no mass. They're funny, but they don't have real depth to them. You know, they don't have a reality behind them. It's a joke. That's by definition what it is. I see that it really interests me to build a world for a joke, to add the empathy, to add the universe, to add the reality to it. So with that wig story, I thought, what about a Hasidic woman in her really cloistered world who builds these beautiful wigs for other religious women? I was like, what about her being in Manhattan and seeing a man with such stunning hair? You know, you'd never approach a strange man, especially a random, not Jewish man with long hair. You know, like, what if she sees this guy and just has to have his hair? Like, that becomes story to me. Like, it's joke that becomes fable that becomes story. So back to people, I haven't thought of a good double, but you just, you know, mentioned Matisyahu, the singer who got really religious and then got famous being a religious singer, and then I think is less religious again, is left. But I was thinking, you only get one switch in life. You know what I'm saying? Like, you can go Democrat to Republican, Republican to Democrat, and the other side will embrace you and welcome you for seeing the light, you know, like that notion. Or like my narrative, you know, I'm very thankful to get to talk to people and to get interviewed. My narrative, just the story that goes along with me, is he grew up religious and now he's secular. And then you can go the other way. Like, if you stop drinking, we will support you, but we're not going to help you start drinking again. Like, that's the point. Like, get another chip, stick with it, like, you know, stay on the path. Like, you get to veer once and then that becomes your true path. But then I was thinking about it. I get teased all the time. My wife, my friends, everyone is like, you're so not religious, but man, you have the most religious soul. You know, like, my wife really, I feel like I won't do the most basic Jewish things, but then she'll catch me doing some extraordinarily obscure ritual, you know, like just something so out there that's like, you know, the deep dive thing that I'll just do reflexively. And she'll be like, I saw that, you know, like she thinks she's going to come home and I'll be koshering the kitchen and like a Woody Allen movie, almost have a long white beard down to the floor all of a sudden. Like, it's really in me. And I thought about that, but I'm interested in switches. Like, the last book, Dinner at the Center of the Earth, everything's a doubling, everything's a double person. And back to my first book, Gilgal of Park Avenue, it's where a guy has an epiphany. And I seem to be obsessed with the radical and quick shift. But in this case, I was just thinking about myself. Like, my sister was up for my book launch, my very religious sister. We had Shabbat dinner, like Friday night traditional dinner at my mom's house. And I'm there with my wife and daughter. I love the songs. I love the food. You take an extra Zantac, you'll be fine with the heartburn. But nonetheless, like, it's so nice to me. And those memories are so nice. I don't live that way anymore. But I was like, isn't it almost natural, the notion that I might one day be like, I miss that. That actually is the world for me. So yeah, I was thinking about that, which is how I get to someone like Larry, who becomes Shuli, where he leaves the world. And his father says to him before he dies, like, they have this moment at the front of the book before his father dies, like he's remembering those last moments where his father's like inside. Like, it's the kind of thing that rabbis would tell me as a kid, like, you like, look as if you're looking at someone's soul. But I thought about that, like, his father thinks this is just a stage, because that's what happens when you leave religion. You know, people think it's maybe, what do you call it, rumspringen?
Yeah, rumspringen, yeah. For the Amish, yeah.
Yeah, for the Amish, like, oh, take your year. I thought it's a very sensible thing to have that year. Like, you'll come
your
back,
gap year,
get
from
out
the
of
religion.
Your system. A gap year, yeah. So that was my point, like, it should be really natural for people to be born again. Like, that's what Shuli is. He's born again. But now I'm so glad you brought up Matisyahu. I was really trying to think of an example of someone who goes this way and then they come back the other way.
It would be really nice that if we can hold on to the things in religion that we like,
yes,
and the things that we don't like, we could find a way to let them hit the road.
It is a pleasure to talk to you. My buddy Glenn Weldon, who's a wonderful writer, you know, his two books are, you know, he did a Batman book and a Superman book. He's like the NPR comics guy, does a lot of stuff. He's a critic, a cultural critic, and many things. But I was talking to him, we did an event you know, at Politics and Prose in D.C., a wonderful bookstore. And Glenn was saying to me, it was really a sweet friend thing. We went to grad school together. He was just making the point, which is, I'm like shy to admit it here, but in front of the people who came to the event, thank you, people. But he was saying, like, I don't think your 24-year-old self that I met, you know, the long-haired self, I'm going to tell you a long-haired story just randomly, but Chris Adrian and my buddy Aaron, but I think it was Chris started this, but I had such long hair when I showed up, they told everyone else in the program as a naughty thing that I was the drummer from Rat and had taken some time off from the band to get an MFA. And I'd really meet people like, oh, you're that drummer guy. And I was like, I am not.
Bobby Blotzer, yes.
Oh, you even know his name. But isn't that a funny thing? Like, we still laugh about it. I was like, that is so funny. But yeah, they started that rumor, which was a joy. Anyway, I love Chris. Oh yeah, so Glenn had said, like, I don't think your 24-year-old self could have written that. And I think, oh my God, maybe I'm mellowing. Like, things change. Like, to leave a religion, you have to like get stretched like a rubber band and like snapped and shot off. You know, like the amount of pressure it takes. I often compare it like gingerly to, and again, I'm so glad if things are changing and we need to stay on the right direction, which is, you know, tolerance and empathy and humanity and recognizing that there are different kinds of people. But again, I will not see our country go to a way where it's going to be a big deal for people to come out of the closet or acknowledge their sexuality. But it's like, I think about what it is to grow up in a home where it's not even sensible to me, the idea that you think things could be passed on in an unbroken way for eternity. That you can say, oh yes, we are heteronormative here and we are for all generations. It makes so much sense for someone to be like, oh, well, I don't feel that way. You know, we're all religious. Like, that's where story comes from then. Like, go back to Fiddler on the Roof. Like, that's the point. If you have 10 kids and you're like, all of you are going to be religious, you would assume one of them's going to be like, not for me. One of them's going to be 10 times more religious. One of them is going to be less. If we're actually unique beings, the idea that someone would have a different makeup, you know, like, is so natural. But for me, I think when I was a kid, I was really so religious. Like, I loved certain parts of it, but I felt like I felt on the outside always. And then I think about friends who grew up in a house where they said, you know, you're supposed to be this way. And they're like, you know, I'm not this way. You know, whether, as I'm saying, like on a sexuality front, like that's a really clear metaphor to me. What this sense is, where you're told this is the only way to be, this is the way you have to be. And you know, in your makeup, that it's not who you are. And then comes with that a terrible fear, if you aren't told otherwise, to say like, oh, so then I guess I'll be the way I'm supposed to be, but I'm just going to be unhappy. You know, like, it's just not a fit. I think about that so much as a notion of people not knowing that there's an outside world. You know, like, I really, there is no cultural Judaism. I get it. If you, you know, bring in people from my world or my family, they'll explain to you the best way to be part of a religion would be to practice religion. It is quite logical. It is a very fair point to make. Like, what else would the religion of Judaism be but a religion? And it wasn't until I like was so far afield till I got to Jerusalem that I was like, oh, it can also be an identity and a culture. It's a mind-bending concept. But that was so freeing to me. But, you know, back to like this character, Larry, who's a pressurized form of it. Sometimes to leave, you really have to go so, so far away. Like, oh, that's a line in this book. I don't know how it's said in the book. I can't remember the wording of it. But almost that rebellion is actually a form of connection too. Like, you rebel against something, it is a form of interaction. So when
yeah, it's not apathy.
Yeah. Yes. Cause I know friends like that. Like, you know, I was thinking of different writer friends. This is a point the writer Jonathan Safran Foer made. I can think of the whole story. I won't unpack the whole story here, but it went into my head as an idea about actually not caring about something, actually thinking a thing is irrelevant. That's being free of it. You know, but yes, pushing back is such an acknowledgement of its existence. You know, like, I mean, that's our whole process. You know, one of the things that is tearing apart our republic, you know, is this notion that, like, of just a certain shamelessness that any kind of attention is good attention. You know, like, I was raised and still believe there can be, I would not like negative attention, but this idea of all of us feeding things, certain people, like feeding them with attention, it really is an investment. So yes, to leave, sometimes the pushback is so hard, it sends you really far afield. But when you actually find a good place, like, I'm actually comfortable with ideas of religion now, certain, I don't have to push back against it. And I think it allowed for a different kind of exploration that allows a certain stripe of love in it that allows this book. In the end, it's a book about redemption and about faith and about a really good person trying to put things right. You know, this also gets back to the Larry-ness of Shuli in this book, like this character, this other side of self. Like, I feel like in the same way when we get onto this conversation, and I'm a dad now, and I think maybe one of the driving things for this book is it sometimes frustrates, you know, a journalist or an audience member where they'll be like, well, what do you believe on this front? What's your answer about God or those things? And I was like, it's sort of like if you ask me about hockey right now, I mean, maybe I'm like, okay, I'm down to the Habs or the Maple Leafs, you know, like this notion that I don't have to have invested in, spend an enormous amount of thought thinking about like, who my favorite, you know, hockey team, like who's my most legendary, like haven't thought a lot about hockey or sports in general, you know? So I think maybe as a parent recognizing, you know, we're in Brooklyn where we really kind of do, at least in my neighborhood, really try and practice what we preach. You know, like my daughter celebrates every holiday at school. She comes home learning all these things. And I was like, oh, yes, I guess we're going to identify as a, like step one, are we going to say like when she just celebrated, you know, the Holi festival at school where they taught them about that, or, you know, where she comes home and it's Chinese New Year or, you know, or Christmas, whatever. Like I'm going to be like, okay, we are not Buddhists. We are not like, oh yeah, I guess we are Jews. You know, like I think part of it is having to wrestle, like I'm probably going to have to answer some questions and decide what I want to impart as a parent. Probably around yesterday, but even hearing you say that, I like nod like a good secular person, but that's it. I'm, you know, it's what you got right to the core. You know, you state so clearly you were really, you know, a believer and then you thought this, and now that's what you think. And that's what I get teased for is I'm a really bad, like a failed atheist. I feel like I strive towards not being religious the way other people work on their faith, because you're like, you know, like, oh, I decide God doesn't exist. I'm like, let's not get crazy. You know what I'm saying? Like, let's not go on record with that. You know, I thought about it and he comes up a lot, but Philip Roth was a friend. Again, there's that back to the dirty scene in this book. That comes up too. You go big or go home if you're going to have a scene like that, because there's a previous pressure and you're like, you better make sure yours is current and stands alone in its own way. But yes, like at his funeral, he did not have a Jewish funeral. Like he did not want certain religious elements that are basic givens. And I thought about that because I am also of secular people. I'm probably of the what does it hurt category. You know what I'm saying? Like, well, you might as well hedge your bets. Like,
but is there any part of the process that you don't identify with and say, you know, you can leave that part out. You can do
A million things. But I'm saying the definitive, like, I'm a God-fearing, non-religious person. You know, like in this weird.
So you're like, doing like a Pascal's Wager thing?
Yeah. Well, it's not even conscious, but I just see it's hard. You know, this is what I look at as a writer. I think we're talking about Jewish stuff. Like the woman next to me on the plane, as we're about to take off from Houston, she does, I can see her praying and she crosses herself. And I was like, I'll take it. It does not going to hurt. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like back to wagers. Like, I'm glad someone on the plane is praying. Like, good. You pray to someone, like we'll take it on this flight. So it's not even like a hedging. It's more, and I definitely get in trouble for this and it takes so long to explain, but I almost need my fainting couch when I say this is my most Jewish book yet. I feel like people are baffled. I'm baffled. Like, how could it be more Jewish than the others? Because those are already the most Jewish books. Like, what could be more most than already the most, you know? But I don't write about Jews because it's just a universe to me. I write about people. Like, I refuse to see myself as a qualified form of person. I'm not like a type of American. I get to be as American as anyone else. Like, why shouldn't I? Like, you know what I'm saying? My family, I call us Mayflower Jews. We've been here for generations and generations. Like, that's the notion. I think I grew up feeling Jewish in America. And why I moved to Israel is there's plenty of Jews in Israel. There I was the American. And I was like, I finally feel like an American. But I guess what I'm getting at is what interests me is having grown up in a black and white world is gray space, that everything is both things, you know, like, you know, this idea of trying to hold two polarities at once. Like, to your point, I really do have very clear beliefs in my front brain and logical stuff. But it's not even about like making a wager, like philosophical things like that, splitting the difference or holding those two points. It's more like I think about how hard it is to repattern your synapses. You know, I see now why, you know, why childhood is important. You know, like, look at Friends. There are even these studies now, whether it's war or, you know, like, I mean, specific war, whether, like you say, the Holocaust, like a genocide, or just different things that trauma, they even talk about inherited trauma now. Like, it may affect you know,
expression of DNA.
It's so crazy that it's like, which is already upsetting. Like, it's enough if you have to be traumatized that you're going to pass on parts of your trauma. But in one's own, the arc of one person's life, like, it really is hard not to be shaped by experience, you know, like that. That's the idea. Your thoughts form, and then you can change those thoughts, you know, back to having grown up in one world. Like, again, this is a very specific moment in American history where I feel like on certain fronts, people are actively working to lose ground on issues of tolerance. I mean, they're burning black churches. You know, it's terrifying what's happening. People being empowered to speak hate is a true terrible thing, you know, like that we all need to fight together. I literally watch how my first time raising children, but like, oh, they see everything. They absorb everything. They are sponges. But if you don't teach them to think a certain way about something, it's not even going to be like the things that are, it's so beautiful to me to see certain things that like, I would have thought like that is not standard behavior. That is not a standard way to be or act, or it's so beautiful to me. Like, you don't have to hook those wires up if you don't want to, you know, whether it's on, you know, as I said, I hate the word tolerance because I don't want to be tolerated. I don't think you want to be I like the word respect, but if you teach certain, like, it is,
I'll take tolerance.
Yeah, you'll take tolerance. Okay. But I'm saying that's the idea is like, yes, is that I think I'm always wrestling with that my brain was wired up a certain way and I've rewired it, but that self, I think other people are maybe better at undoing that. My friends who left organized religion are much better at being not religious than I am.
And I was just thinking now that as people who suffer from Alzheimer's dementia,
yes,
they often revert back to how they were as children. And,
yes,
and those are the memories that are the strongest with them. And maybe that's just kind of a natural thing for all of us as we get older, we soften in that regard. And
oh, that's really nice.
Maybe fade back toward the way we were raised.
Yes. And one should hope to like lean in that way. I was like, there's always two directions to go. Yes. Some people get meaner, some people get nicer. But yes, that is.
We start without hair and teeth. We end without hair and teeth.
Exactly. That is interesting. Yes. Especially right when you're that long-term memory, that it really is there. You can pull these things out of memory.
My long hair story.
Yes.
Iced Tea body count on the stage.
Excellent.
Easter Sunday.
Awesome.
1992. Yes. Tulsa, Oklahoma. Standing there enjoying the show, and a young woman walks up to me as he's singing about shooting cops, and she goes, "Is your hair naturally curly?"
That's funny.
I go, "Yeah, it is." And she goes, "Thanks." And she walked back over to her boyfriend. So at one point early on in the book, there is a tremendous shift in the book, and the flyleaf doesn't include that shift. So you've mentioned it just briefly, but we're going to try to keep that for the readers to find out themselves. But there's a point where essentially it's an intervention of his sister brings in a couple of people from the synagogue to get Larry to commit to saying the Kaddish.
Yeah, that doesn't feel like spoiler. I have to say,
And so it just reminded me a little bit of that scene in Raising Arizona where High was in front of the parole board saying, am I saying what you want to hear or what, back and forth. And it was just, no one was satisfied with an answer he would give. Yes.
I'm always happy for a Coen Brothers reference. That's funny. I just brought up a quite spirited discussion when I brought up Serious Man at one of these events, and we were all just, I had a lovely talk after about, I really love that movie. But yeah, baby Nathan is the baby in Raising Arizona. So yes, that's my namesake. I thought about this back to that last novel, Dinner at the Center of the Earth, like where I had to read, I hadn't read any literary thrillers really, you know, just this idea of educating myself. But it's really fun now, these last two books, to have real spoilers. I was like, I always say, like, all of us literary writers were like, I write for the music of language. Like, it also doesn't hurt if people really want to find out what's happening and are turning pages. But the story to story in a different way, the pacing of this book, I think sometimes people are really sensitive. If, like, I can see a writer sort of, you know, wince if they've spent, you know, 10 years on a novel and someone's like, oh, that was the best 74 minutes of my life. I really enjoyed that. You're like, I spent a decade on that. But I really intentionally built this story. There's a lot of big ideas that we've been talking about and I've woven them in, but I really wanted, you know, in a way, if you're a fast reader kind of person, for someone to sit down and like devour this book, like to laugh, 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 cry. I literally thought about that structure. Laugh, 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 happy, cry. I was actually thinking about that. Anyway, so there are spoilers and things that happen, but yes, we can't talk about it without talking about that first jump to being born again and to this idea where there's a real confrontation because his sister needs him to say the prayer. Like, it's not a joke. If he doesn't say it, his father's spirit will literally be like feeling the hellfires. Like, no joke. That's a lot for a religious person to say. If you don't do this, our father is going to burn in hellfire. You know, that's not light. But the scene is light. The scene is funny. But yes, she brings the rabbi. The sister sort of confronts the brother and corners him with the rabbi and this lovely man from town who's part of like the Chevra Kadisha, the people who wash the body. And they really circle around him to impart upon him that you have to say it. And much like the scene you're referencing in Raising Arizona. But like, you know, these things where the belief that isn't it okay if someone just thinks it's being done? And as like, I think that gets back to maybe where we are as a country right now. One of the things that obsesses me, I didn't build the book for this. The launch of this book, I launched at my local bookstore, Greenlight Bookstore. I live on Green down the block. Love those people. It's a really warm neighborhood thing. And Colson Whitehead, who's a friend and a friend of the store, he was, you know, talking to me about that. You know, he was interviewing, moderating, and he asked if I like wrote this book as an antidote, as like a break for the times, like just about a guy who just believes in something and just wants to do right by everyone and put things right, a like super ethical being. But I think I really wrestle with those notions. Like, it's not only what we believe as people that we're responsible for. I mean, I'm exploring it. The book, I don't lecture. I am a reader. Books that I love mostly wrestle with questions. They like edify, they get me thinking. You know, this is a John Gardner concept, which is a book is a place to test values, to reflect. You know, he compares it to like a chemistry experiment. Like, a didactic book is broken. What a bore to be lectured on anything or to read someone's point. I don't want to hear a point. I just want to enter a world, you know, be absorbed in a story and think about things. But yes, I've been thinking about the notion about my responsibility, not only to my beliefs, but our responsibility to other people's beliefs. And maybe I use my own family as an example. Like, that's it. My family's so religious. And I say, like, you know, my sister sitting in the front row at the reading, even if it's not her usual world, and even if I'm saying some shocking things, like, she believes in the arts because I believe in the arts. She supports my space in that world. And I think about the not knowing of things, like a Jewish traditional kosher kitchen, you separate the milk and the meat. Probably a lot of people have heard that. So there's two sets of silverware, but I think about it. It's called, you know, trafing things up, making them not kosher. But if like I was alone in my sister's kitchen and I accidentally made a knife not kosher, like unfit for use, nobody's gonna know if I took a meat knife and touched milk with it. Like, literally no one's going to know. Nothing is happening to the molecular structure of the knife. My sister, who is the religious person in her family, they have done nothing. So if there's any kind of God who has justice, they're not going to be punished for it.
But you would take it seriously, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I would never put it back in the drawer. Nobody's looking. Like, that's the point. So that's part of what this book explores. So in the scene you're bringing up, he's telling them they need to hear he's going to say it for 11 months. And he is really trying to tell them that, like, because he knows that's what they need to hear, and he just doesn't believe it matters. So he's like, I'll do it. His sister sort of explodes. If he said he wouldn't do it, she would have exploded less, but she literally gets so upset because he says, I'll do it, because she knows. You know, that's the point of obligation that I'm also thinking about. Even she knows it's fallen to a person who simply does not have the makeup. That's what I'm talking about. There really is, when we talk about trying to get people to be who they aren't, some people have a specific makeup, and he just, at that moment in his life, is not the man for the job.
She's exploding at the hopeless situation that it is.
Yeah.
She's screaming into the abyss at that point.
Yes. Which is why I love the proxy thing. And I like that the rabbi starts there. You start with the ideal form. Like gym stuff, you can go in and say, okay, I'm going to do 200 push-ups today. And then you get going, you're like, or, you know, how about 3 sets of 8? That's a good place to start. Like, you start with an ideal goal, and that's it. You know, some things you don't back down on. If you're writing a novel, you better not publish it until it's finished, until it's the book you'd stand by for life. But I'm saying, you know, most things in life are about finding a fit, about making things work. We got to meet in the middle.
But I do have to say that of the religious people out there, and since I'm not religious, I don't think they're working nearly hard enough to win me back.
Yeah, that's...
If they believe heck is that bad, then why aren't they trying harder?
You know, that's about bridges and stuff. Like, I think about that. That goes back to that concept of respect. Like, you know, my father's passed away a decade ago. Like, we made it work. Like, we choose as a family to make it work. We know what subjects to discuss at dinner. We know how to not blow up Thanksgiving. And that's what I took away in this book, that's what starts the book, is taking away that bridge where you say, like, the sides do not meet, because what you're talking about now is dual realities. You know what I'm saying? You're saying you live in one reality, another group lives in a different reality. Nobody's getting you on the outreach front, on the understanding front. And I saw that when I was living in Jerusalem. That's maybe the sharpest example. And it inspired the last book for sure, and definitely plays into how I think about the religious and secular rift in America, because we didn't have it, or just the right-left rift in America, though they usually match more or less. But like, I was living in Jerusalem for years, and it took me a long time to understand, like, oh, I'm a Jewish guy. I live in Jerusalem and Yerushalayim. The holy site is Har HaBayit, the Temple Mount. And then I understood, oh, my Palestinian neighbor, they're literally on the same street, breathing the same air. They live in Il-Quds. Like, they don't live in Jerusalem. They live in Il-Quds. And that same spot where the Temple Mount is for me, you know, that's Haram al-Sharif for them. Like, I was like, oh, it is literally, it is not a disagreement. It is not something on a spectrum. It is two realities. And I feel like, to your point, that in my life, I've never seen America have such a sharp split where there's no connecting threads. You know, from the moment after the last election where someone put up two pictures and said the picture with less people has more people, the person who says it, for whatever reason that guy says it, or for whatever reason someone requested that it be said, that's none of my business. But I'm saying, back to trickle down, like, certain rooms, I know what cities I'm in, and I'll be like, okay, this is probably the politics of that room, almost 100%, you know, one way or the other. And then cities where I'm like, okay, this is probably a split room. But let's say it's a split city where I know the room's like red and blue. I feel like I could, like, what a cool experiment. I could put up two pictures of an inauguration and the room's going to split and people are not going to agree with each other. And they're both going to be saying, you're looking at a picture with less people and saying it has more people. Like, that is not an opinion. That is a split reality, like a literally split reality. Again, I know what I see. It's like those things where they're like, what color is the dress, or what song, these things that go viral.
I know, but at least in the terms of religion, it's what might be. We are speculating on what might be, and they have a set belief on what that might be is.
Yes.
But this is the actual people on the mall thing.
Yes.
That's a different type of split reality, is ignoring the physical reality of the world as opposed to differing on the metaphysical.
But I would say the person who's seeing what they're seeing, that is their reality. Like, but I'm saying the atheist will say concretely, this is impossible. There is no such force. And the religious person will say, like, concretely, you are ignoring, like, there is only this force. I guess that's what story does. It lets you explore through people. So you're stepping outside and saying objective facts. That's what I'm talking about, is objective facts are being dismantled. 2 + 2 has to equal 4. It just has to. But this idea that we're introducing a 5 category is, you know, very complicated. Maybe the best way to say it is, I believe that there has to be truth. There must be true things, you know what I'm saying, that we can hold dear and as true. But I like to look to explore in this notion of what it is when what people hold true. Yeah, when that bridge is gone, I guess, is one of the explorations that sort of tortures me. As I said, I live in the gray space. I left a world of absolutes, and the world is grayer than that. I don't know. I wrestle with this notion. We're spiraling out into like super metaphysics, which I love, but I'm afraid of scaring everyone away. But yes, it's an interesting space that obsesses me, especially when it deals with human beings. I guess that I'm adding the empathy in. I'm not talking about it in theoretical or from up above, or demanding like, well, this picture has less people, and that's for sure. I'm talking about just a human being who sees more people in there. Like, that's what interests me, you know, putting those two people together.
And dang it, just treat people with respect.
That would be lovely.
That's all you have to do.
Yeah. I have to say, back to my New York life, like, the subway's gotten so much better. You know, part of it's like economics and how things change and all that
stuff.
Everyone's
complaining about the subway.
The subway does not work. It has never been so broken in my life. I was just listening to Robert Caro talk on the radio yesterday in my travels, talking about Robert Moses, you know, like saying, oh, we're going to put this money into roads and not into the subway. The things you pay for, back to things, that idea, you do need to look towards the future and invest in the future, because there are things we have to pay for, but we are surely paying for it with our subway right right now it is broken. I just mean New York, tough city that it is, it's become extraordinarily friendly. Back to, you know, intent like that, things that used to be like a fight on the subway, it's really beautiful to me where I'd be like, oh, look at this. You can have a group think and really work towards it. But yes, I find it an extraordinarily pleasant New York time.
But when it goes back to Larry, if he would have made the investment 20 years ago, his life would have been so much simpler.
Yes. Back to that. Yes. If religion's your game, yes, it was very costly for him to have left. But it gave me a novel.
So how hard was it to make such a compact novel?
It's nice to talk to you. There's this pause as I'm like, oh, if I ever pause, it's usually because there's a vulnerability coming and I'm like, oh, this is something that's close to me, but I want to talk about it. So this is the first book that that I wrote in the way, again, we're just talking about metaphysics. So it's a weird space in my brain to talk about it. It felt like writing a short story. And I don't know how to explain that yet. I don't have the words for it yet, but it really also came to me almost in like a fever. And I've heard these stories of other writers, like a rough draft takes me 3 years. I wrote this rough draft in 3 months. Yes, I then polish for years and go crazy and torture myself and everyone around me and do the whole tortured artist thing. But nonetheless, it really felt like a short story as it was taking form. And I think it was really important to me. I think I knew that it needed this kind of pacing. I'm a professor. They call me professor sometimes. Whatever. I'm writer in residence at NYU. I teach at NYU in the grad school there. One of the nice things, if we're talking about respect, it's really nice when you do something and you get something back from it. So it's nice to teach because I have healthcare. That's a good thing in this country. But it's really rewarding, A, to see the students grow and become an old man of letters, like their books come out, they become writers. That's all fun. But this notion of me having to put things into words, you know, for them, I actually end up, while I'm writing, I'm like, oh, I actually have that in a conscious sentence as advice that I've given them. And it really comes back, you know, to me that I like them not to try and put labels on things. It's really suffocating to them. It's really pressure. Someone will say like, oh, I want to be a literary writer. Like, I'm worried this is a YA novel. I think the other students say I'm writing a YA novel. And I was like, if it ends up being a YA novel, you'll buy a bigger house. You know what I'm saying? Like, you should only end up being called a mystery writer, even if you wanted to be. Like, there's other genres go so much bigger than someone who writes literary fiction. But this idea of what things are, you know, the only category, I was going to say, the only time you need to know what it is if you're calling it memoir. We can go through all the stories of people who get busted for having absolutely published a novel as a memoir or lied, you know, not in some happy humorist stretch of things where you say fell down 20 stairs and you actually fell down 4, but you're making a joke. But yes, memoir, don't call it a memoir if it's not a memoir. That is deception. You know, that's not okay. But in all other forms, I gave that advice to myself. Like, I was writing this thing and I was like, I don't have to call it a short story novel. It ended up being a novel, but I think I could have like scared myself away if I put this pressure on. And then I thought about this weird literary made up fact of mine that if people really love a short story in America, or basically a haiku, if we love it enough in this country, we call it a novel, even if it's like 8 words long. I actually made a list. That's the thing I was embarrassed to say, but I literally made a list. I never write to word length ever. I write to time because if you hear how fast I'm talking, I can type fast too. You know, I remember once doing it back to Berlin. I lived in Berlin for a few months at the American Academy in Berlin to do some work there. I was like, oh, it's a new space. Maybe I'll try writing for word count. So I'm like, oh, I should write 500 words a day. I should write 1,000. I think one day I wrote 20,000. I just kept upping the number. But I was like, that's not how my brain works. I can generate lots of words. I work for hours. That's better for me. But this is the first time I thought, how long are these books that are so close to our hearts as Americans? And I made a list like Old Man in the Sea, Gatsby, Animal Farm, you know, Orwell's, he's British, but it's liked here. And those books, some of them are basically pamphlets. But I was like, oh, if we truly, truly love it, we will promote you to novel. So that was a really freeing moment where I was like, oh, it'll be as long as it is. It ended up being, you know, a 200-page book. So yes, a full-size novel. But I remember that moment where I thought I was started out thinking I'm writing a short story. And I was like, oh, it's bigger than that. And that's how I kept myself calm with this list on the wall. And I would actually check word count every day. And as I got past each of those novels, I would cross them off, literally. And when I got past the last one, I was like, oh, I guess this is a full-length novel.
So there wasn't a bunch of paring off to get it down to that length?
I always pair off. But of all the books, this is the one that its shape, back to that dream state where the shape was sort of built into it, where I was already consciously, that's what I'm saying, this consciousness, the idea of skipping 20 years, negative space, all these craft-related or highfalutin, you know, farty, writerly ideas, a lot of them are more in my conscious brain. Because I would say, I don't know if I can claim it for this one, up till this book, every single thing I've written, every story has been at least twice as long. Like I finished my, you know, Dinner at the Center of the Earth, the Israel-Palestine, you know, Gaza sort of spy-ish yet literary allegorical crazy novel. I call it a turducken because they're all stuffed in there. But, you know, I finished the rough draft and it's 650 pages and I know right then it's going to be a 300 page book. My Argentina novel, Ministry of Special Cases, I have like a footnoted draft in some box that's probably like tipping out at 1,100 pages and then I cut it in half and then I cut it in half again. Yes, I love to find the book, you know, that there's that, you know, super worn out, you know, Michelangelo quote, you know, or idea. But yes, I love finding story inside of story because that's how, back to believing in realities, that's how we make a reality. Like you and I talking today, like it's really a pleasure to talk to you. But part of that pleasure is you and I bringing in random details. Like the story of both of us in front of these microphones is about 20 million pages long if we're going to do all this stuff. But we talked about us both having, you know, crazy long hair, or you talk about, you know, you say you lived in Germany for longer than me. I say, oh, I spent some time in Germany. Like you start chipping away at other parts of life. You said Tulsa, concert in Tulsa, you know, iced tea. And I say like, oh, you know, I was in Tulsa 2 days ago. Like that's long ago Tulsa, recent Tulsa. It's those connecting things with the absence of everything around them. Not how did either of us get to Tulsa, but just Tulsa, Tulsa, Germany, Germany, long hair, long hair. That's what connects me and you. And that also what makes us seem real. If we filled in everything, it's like filling in the Grand Canyon. The Grand Canyon is cool for being carved out. Like you want to level it up. It's going to lose itself.
And I forgot what I was going to say.
That's the best part about taping.
And I am an editor. I'm an okay interviewer. I'm a really good editor.
Oh my, that is the most random thing. My friend who I mentioned, the friend who used to read Deborah Brody, who's a wonderful editor. She's passed away, but she's the one who had a beautiful speaking voice and used to read for visually impaired people, record books for those libraries, which you do here, which is awesome. Oh, but she's the one who said that it really changed my life. And her son, who's my friend, he says it to me all the time, but literally it's such a nice thing to know about yourself. And now I see why you asked the last question. You know, am I allowed to curse on this? No.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Anyway. Oh, but he used to say to me, be like, oh, Nate writes okay, but he rewrites like a you know, like literally you need to know which part of your brain you start to learn your process. And for me, like that's also become freeing. Write as long as you, I know I love to rewrite. That's where I do my work. So as soon as you say that editing thing, it so speaks to me. It is about the final thing where you're like, this is what goes into the world. I'm obsessed with process, and that a process, by virtue of being a process, has multiple parts to it. That's what is so exciting to me and keeps me interested. It's not exactly an action sport. You know, it's not like Free Solo. I'm not like, I hope I invest that much, but like that idea, you know, The Fall is, for a fiction writer, hurts just as much. It doesn't actually kill you. It feels like it's going to kill you. Free Solo Fall will really kill you. This will feel like it'll kill you, but it likely most of the time won't, though we can come up with those examples. But yes.
But you're not damaging the people you love.
Yeah, like yeah. Depending on the book also. That goes back to memoir. You know, some novels and more memoirs, you can also like actually hurt the people you love. But yes, fair point. But yes, I love to hear you say that. I really get it because I have the same head. Like once there's a thing to work on, that's when I roll up my sleeves. Like same back to students. Will they be upset? Like, oh, I finished my novel, but it's broken all kinds of way. I'm like, don't you understand? You have a novel. Yes, it's broken, but you can fix something. Like, that
it's
is not
there, though.
Yeah, it's not its true form. And those sweet moments, right, when you make just the right cut, it just changes the difference. I have another play coming out. I think the Old Globe's going to announce it's safe enough. The director, I talked to him in San Diego and he said it on stage. And I was like, oh, I've been really quiet about it because it's unofficial. But I was like, okay, you said it in front of people. Now I'll say it in front of people. So this is the first time I'm saying it. But yeah, like working on the plays, I had a play in my first book, For the Relief of Unbearable Urges. There's a story, The 27th Man. And I wrote that story into a play, which, you know, Nora Ephron produced it. And then it went to the Old Globe with, you know, Barry Edelstein directing and the amazing Oscar Eustace. What a wonderful place. I mean, the Public Theater, did I say the Public? Anyway, but it opened at the Public Theater in New York. But working with them, working with people, it was so cool to see people sort of with the same disease in a way, the same obsessions, but there's different categories. Like, you do sound, you do lighting, you do costuming. But it was so cool to me. I really brought that experience back to my fiction. Like, you'd be watching a scene that was almost as dramatic as it should be. There'd be like a little something missing. And then it would suddenly hit. And I'd be like, that was it. We'd all be like, that was it. I'd be like, why is it suddenly it? And the sound guy would say like, oh, I added a tiniest little bit of ticking, you know, like these little changes that someone could make with a light or with a costume. I really brought it back to work, like what you do, because rehearsal, tech, all that stuff is about, it's like fine tuning in a group. But yes, back to editing a show like this or editing a novel, if you have a certain brain, that is a true joy. I don't have opinions on anything, but like if a film friend invites me, if I get to see like the editing room, like you can show me almost the exact same shot. Like, show me almost the exact same picture, like 94 versions. My brain loves to look at all of them and say, like, that's the one, 72. That is the ideal version of this almost exact same photo. Like, I go nuts for that stuff.
There's just such a joy in people that are good at what they do, especially hearing them talk about it. There's a YouTube video of a guy, his family is in making bed linens. That's what their entire thing is. And he goes through and they give him a couple of sets of bed linens at a time and he grades them and he talks about what makes this one worth this much and everything. And it's just fascinating to watch this guy talk about sheets for 30 minutes.
I have to say, those are the people I like in my life. Like, I feel very fortunate. I just always like being around people who their thing, like, it's very nice if you found your thing. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's tax season. Like, I went to see my accountant. Like, that idea, like, that guy, like, man, does he love to account. You know what I'm saying? Like, I love going in there. Like, I just like being around people. You know what I'm saying? I want to go to the dentist and I want, like, you know, she should just love dentisting. You know, like, I find it, you know, when you say like that, like linens, like friends, that's funny. I have a friend who actually does like house, like she has napkins. And, but yeah, like, I just love obsessives who really care about craft, people who just love, who lose themselves in their work and something. I just love to be around that energy. It really excites me. I literally, like, tears in my eyes. Like, I think I cried after the first meeting at the play with the costume designer to see someone dive so deep. You know, she had researched the characters in the story and like made ideas off that. She had found the people they were based on and gone back through history to look at what they'd worn across time. She had like studied our set and the lights to see like how things, you know, like it was just so crazy to see these charts and images and like what went into her brain to build like, and this is the suit that will be worn. It was so moving to me. Like, I really cherish that kind of head.
So what's it like just writing dialogue?
Really fun. If you like dialogue, I like dialogue. I didn't notice that before, that I really do enjoy writing dialogue. It was cool. It's nice to learn stuff in life. I love to learn new things. I don't beat myself up about quitting on anything. Like, I go through phases, like obsessive. I'll just be like, I'm doing pottery now. And then people are like, how's the pottery? I'm like, I don't do pottery. Or, you know, they'll be, you know, like now I'm sitting here across from you in a CrossFit hat, you know, we're like obsessed with the gym in this way. And they'll be like, oh, how's your yoga practice? I'm like, yoga, I can't even touch my toes. Like, I do things in these very intense ways and then forget about them. The only thing that stays constant in my life is the writing. Like, that's the thing I do not quit. But learning a new form, you know, was so exciting because it's not just working the dialogue. It's that it changes everything. The timing changes completely. And the value systems, like, you know, back to us talking about realities and truth and like the whole system of weights and measures that the world is built on, that you're building, completely changes. First, a very punchy, punchy, fast, really like zippy, awesome, great line of even short story dialogue. Do that on stage and you'll hear people snoring. Like, it will be so slow. Like, things need to be so fast for a play. But then, you know, a play's happening in real time. You don't scream stop in the audience, though people seem to have been screaming out lately, you know, whatever. But we've had some play incidents, some of them really terrifying lately. Anyway, nonetheless, generally you're not supposed to scream out from the audience. Even we saw Frozen in New York because back to the child, like even there, they're like, please don't sing along. Even if you love the songs, children, just listen. Anyway, but that notion on stage, like you can't stop or rewind or just, you can't even enjoy the play at your speed. You know, I didn't know it for a long time. I'm a reader. I am one of the slowest readers around. Of people who really love books, I read so extraordinarily slowly. This is like a wifely argument. Like I'll literally, let's say I have to send some important letter or I want to send a piece in, you know, like there's a, say I want my wife to read a page and I'll be, could, you know, this is really, really important. You know, could you, do you mind reading this for me? And she'll be like, it's good. You can send it off. And I'll say, I asked you to read it. And she'll be like, I did. And I'm like, oh, sorry, I forgot again. You know, I'll be reading along. I'll be like three lines. And she'll be like, oh, it's clean. And I'll be like, you read. I literally, my brain can't even do it. Point is, as relates to the theater, in writing, you can have your layer inside your layer and your nuance under your nuance. There's a different theater version for that. So dialogue needs to be punchier. Scenes need to be differently timed in a much faster way. But clarity is completely different. You can, like, it's happening in real time and everybody in that room has to understand what's unfolding. So one part of it has to be a million times faster and one part of it, instead of being like super fast or super nuanced, has to be a million times clearer and slower. So yes, fast becomes slow, slow becomes fast. And that just was a massive education and took it back to the other work. The other thing is, a really nice rule of drama, which I'd never thought of consciously. Live theater in a play, a character, you consciously can think about it. You need to see the change. It's such a nice thing to think about with fiction, like somebody has to be transformed. It's not a play without this certain kind of dramatic transformation. And I don't know if that was a conscious thought for fiction, but it's really nice to think about.
Well, yeah, you have to have a dramatic arc.
Yeah, but I think it can be a lot quieter in a novel in a certain way than in a stage play.
What are you working on now?
Touring like crazy. I think I'm in good spirits today, but I get to go home tomorrow. But yeah, I'm usually, it's, again, this is a fun interview and I'm really enjoying the events. So I am physically worn out, but mentally I'm here. I could use a dry cleaner for inside and out. What am I working on? Oh, it's really, there's so many stages of the writing life. This came out on the 26th. I made it a week under 20 years that my average went down. Like it becomes five books in 20 years. That's 4 years a book. I feel perfectly like a respectable individual, even if the average for the first decade was one, you know?
Oh, you're really cranking them out now.
Yeah, it's really fast. I can't even believe it. I'm like, I had a publishing schedule and I hit it. The nice thing about a literary writing a certain kind of fiction is they're very respectful of your process and leave you alone. Nobody's like, where's my book? And the real negative is everybody leaves you alone. They'll still buy you lunch and check in on you. But I'm like, you should have probably yelled at me year six and been like, okay, let's chop off the last 2 years of this. Let's get this done. Oh, nonetheless, it's been with back-to-back books. It's got to be like 5 years or something. It's really weird to be at the start of things. Like, and this is the point at the end of a book, when you're really in deep and you have traction, you're close, you walk around in the world and everything is part of your process. Like the cup on this table, I'm like, I was waiting to see that cup. You know, anything you see on the news or hear or you smell a smell, you're like, that's just the smell I needed. And then there's this really exciting time where I am now, where everything, I have like 94 different ideas and we'll see which one is the real idea. But yes, I have the idea for the next novel and for a nonfiction book and there's a play I want to write. And I'm like, oh, what about, you know, yeah. You know, like I'm going to build this diorama out of, like, there's just structure, form. Yes, I'm lit up with ideas and I'm fiddling, but I'm excited after tour to dig into them. But there's a lot cooking and I guarantee you it will winnow.
How do you decide?
Oh, you know what? It's a nice way, like at this, you know, part of the interview, it closes the circle. I really have been thinking a lot about, you know, how we started talking in here, you know, of what you take from a religious childhood, even if you're not religious anymore. So sacred time and sacred space are really big for me. The work only gets done if you build this routine and if you can do it in the same place, like these notions of repetitiveness that really train the brain. You know, I think it works for religion, sports, arts, certain practices or really helped, you know, me doing a sports metaphor is the giant. I already said hockey once. It's like, what a farce. Like, I don't know anything
but
about
sports. But
you're
building reflexes.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, building reflexes. But I say, like, if like 60,000 people are booing you and you have to hit a foul shot and everyone's screaming with like a bloodlust anger at you because you're not at home and everything's riding on that, like, it's all that practice. Like, you need to have an out-of-body experience to just be like, same, same, just throw in a foul shot. It's going to go in. So, oh, I guess this is where I get religious about, I think I've, you know, was religious about religion and now I'm religious about fiction. I really think sometimes you give yourself over to the process and you just follow along. Like, I'm such a neurotic, everything scares me and makes me worried. But when you ask me which book I'm going to write, it will let itself be known. Like prayer, I will show up and do my work and eventually something will tell me what to work on and I'll stick with that one.
Nathan, it has been a pleasure.
This has been so nice. Thanks for having me.
Nathan Englander is the author of Kaddish.com, which is published by Knopf. I'm Stephen Usery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.